welcome to the Numberphile podcast. Today's guest is Poling Low. She's an American theoretical statistician based in the UK. She's at the University of Cambridge. And what she's doing is some interesting stuff in the world of higher dimensional statistics and differential privacy. You don't know what that is? Don't worry, neither did I. We'll get to that. But let's start at the beginning. So let's start with you then. Where in the world were you born? Where are you from?
Well, when people ask me where I'm from, I say Madison, Wisconsin, because it's easier to say that. In reality, I was born near New York City. But my older brother was born in Madison because my parents had already settled down there. But my father went on sabbatical to New York City for about a year, which is when I was born.
It was a quirk of work that saw you born there.
Right, right.
Madison, Wisconsin. I've never been there. What's Madison, Wisconsin like?
It's a very, well, it's what in America they would call it a college town, a Midwestern college town. So it's a very big university there with like 50,000 students. And then outside of that, well, it's the capital of the state. So there are some lawmakers. And then there are just lots of cows and lots of empty space.
And what was childhood like? Like, what were you like as a girl?
I was pretty shy and awkward, I think. I studied a lot. So my father is a statistics professor. My mother also had her degree in mathematics, but then decided to become a full-time homemaker. So she wanted to make sure that her three kids were very good at math. So that's basically what I did. I mean, I just studied a lot, worked at it.
You had no choice in this, by the way.
No, I didn't. I mean, I was the youngest of three, so I really had no choice.
Are your two older siblings mathy type people?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Also, both your parents and all three kids have become mathy people.
Yeah, and I mean, when I was growing up, there were lots of other parents, especially parents of Asian classmates, who would ask my mom, like, how do you do it? But looking back, I mean, she did it because that was what her full-time mission was, to make sure that we were all very good at math. And she stayed at home and made sure that that happened.
So what would it look like in your house when you were little kids? Would mother be sitting you down with graph paper and pencils and drilling math into you? Or?
Well, I mean, so one thing I remember a lot was like when I was a little child, I mean, I don't know how old I was, but let's say I was like three or something, right? And she would take out the crayon box, and we were not going to color, we were going to count crayons. So we would just, like, every time the crayon box came out, it was to count the crayons. Another thing she liked to do, I was probably a bit older, was to make change with money, right? So to understand what do the different coins mean. So she would sit me down with my two brothers. So one brother is 2.5 years older than me, the other is 5 years older than me. And we all got equal amounts of money. And we were supposed to exchange coins. And what happened was, at the end of the game, my second brother would have the exact same amount of money he started with. My older brother would have twice as much money as what he started with, and I would have nothing. Because the negotiation would be, you know, my second brother would be like, okay, so here's a nickel, give me five pennies. I'm like, okay. Then my oldest brother would say, well, you know, so here's a penny, but it's really, really valuable. So, you know, it's worth a quarter. Give me the quarter. And I'd be like, okay. And later I take the valuable penny and I try to give it back to him. And he's like, no, it's just a penny. So these are the sorts of games in our household. And I also remember my mom, she liked to bake. And so I've sort of inherited that hobby from her, but she would make chocolate chip cookies. And she would say, well, you need to count your chocolate chips before you eat the cookie. So my brother, who's 2.5 years older than me, would count the chips. And while he was counting the chips, I'd just eat my cookie. So when it came time to me, I'd be like, zero. So that's sort of the household I grew up in.
Sounds like they were taking advantage of you a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I like the counting crayons.
I mean, I thought this was completely normal, but looking back, it's sort of something to laugh about.
As a young girl, were you ever drawn to anything else? Was there ever a moment where you could have been drawn to another career or profession? Did you have other interests and passions, or were you just like, it was always going to be numbers?
I mean, I sort of explored around a little bit. So I think in middle school, for some reason, I wanted to get into biology. I mean, I think I just found out what biology was. And I said, well, okay, I think this is interesting. And because I like to read, so my mother said, oh, that's bad, do math. My father said, oh, that's great. So here's a book that you should read if you like biology. And it was a book by Darwin, like a really thick book. It was called The Beak of the Finch. And after I read that, I was like, this is not interesting. My dad, I think inwardly, he's like, wonderful. And then in high school, I really got into American history, I think because I like to read. But actually, I think what got me off of that route was that my older brother, my brother who's 2.5 years older than me, so he was really into competitive math. And that was his thing. Like, he spent all his time preparing for competitions. And I realized that a way to like spend quality time with him was to study with him. So that sort of got me off of this American history. Like, I'm going to spend my time reading books. So, like, I'll work on some problems with him and he can explain to me how they're solved. So
just because you wanted to be with your brother.
Yeah, yeah.
You hear so much about, like, you know, nature versus nurture for people with what careers they do and that. Do you feel like, you know, math was in your genes, or you were nurtured into it by your parents? Or
so it's hard to say, because now, I mean, I have kids, right? And I kind of wonder, like, are they going to be mathematically inclined? But I mean, in my case, I really don't know that. I feel like I would have ended up good at math if my mom just spent like 18 years making sure that I was doing lots of math.
I can imagine some kids being turned off by wanting to do what their parents do and what their parents kind of, you know, drummed into them every day. There'd be like a resistance. You sometimes see that backlash, not with your siblings. Is there a reason for that? Do you think your parents made mathematics fun, or do you think they didn't make it fun but you just loved it anyway? Like, why didn't any of the three of you push back against it?
Well, I think for different reasons. So so my eldest brother, so he first got into competitive math. And I think my parents didn't realize that this was a thing. So they grew up in Singapore, where it was all like, you know, pass your standardized tests, get into the good university and all that. So my brother started doing competitive math like when he was in sixth grade, and he was quite good at it. And
did he go to like math Olympiads and stuff?
Yeah, yeah. So, and then my second brother is very competitive. So he said, well, if my older brother can do this, I want to do it better. And he usually could do it better, even though he was like 2.5 years younger. So for him, it's like, you know, there's a clear path. And for me, I didn't like competitions at all. I still had to do some of this stuff, but I guess I was too much of a conformist to sort of break out of it. Like, I would still wonder to myself, like, you know, why am I doing this? But I, you know, there was the momentum, there was the fact that that's what my brothers did, and I wanted to be, at least at some point, I wanted to be close to one of my older brothers.
Do you remember a point where you suddenly felt, actually, I like this. This is what I want to do. It's not because I'm getting to be with my brother or mum wants me to do it. I'm actually getting pleasure from this.
That was more in college. So at college, going on to grad school. But I mean, so in college, I went to Caltech, which is, you know, everyone studies sort of the basic sciences. You have to take chemistry for the first 2 years, no matter what major you do. You have to take physics for the first 2 years and so on. And then I realized that, you know, I was pretty good at the other disciplines because they used math, but I was much better at math because I just had so much training. And it's nice to do well at stuff, right? So then I sort of focused more on that. And so going into grad school, it was clear that I wanted to do something that was math related.
So when you were coming through high school and choosing to go to college, math still wasn't something you had a passion for. It was just like, well, what else am I going to do?
Yeah. I sort of got pulled along for the ride.
How did your parents feel about all three of you doing math? Were they like over the moon?
I think they would have been rather disappointed if anything else had happened. But actually, so, I mean, I ended up doing my PhD in statistics, and after I made that decision, my dad was really happy. So he didn't want any of us to feel like he had sort of forced us into it. But so my older brothers ended up doing other math-related disciplines. And for me, I ended up doing my PhD in statistics. And actually, I went to UC Berkeley, which is where my dad had gone when he got his PhD. So he was really over the moon.
So you were the one that actually followed the family tradition.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Tell me how your transition from pure math, normal math at college to statistics happened, and why it happened.
Well, so there's sort of the, you know, the story I like to pretend is the true one, and there's the true one.
Tell me the pretend one first.
So the pretend one is like, you know, I was doing pure math and it was great, but I wanted to do something more practical, and, you know, statistics is closer to reality and all that. So then the real reason is that, so there was a particular area of pure math that I became very enthusiastic about early on, and that was through a sequence of various, you know, you meet different professors and they mentor you in different ways. So I ended up sort of getting into abstract algebra and specifically group theory. And I had opportunities to do research projects on group theory in my first few years, even my summer before I started undergrad, and then for like 2 summers after that. So that was my thing. And, you know, I turned out to be pretty good at it. So I took this, well, in Caltech, you often take like the first class on whatever subject, whether it's algebra or analysis or something. And then you have a choice whether to go on to the graduate level, because the graduate students and the undergrads take some classes together. First year PhD students might take some classes with the undergrads. So, and you only need to go beyond in one or two subjects. So for me, I did abstract algebra. So I completely aced the first class in abstract algebra. And then the second class in abstract algebra, I also like completely aced it for the first two quarters. So we had a quarter system. So the first two terms I did really well. And the professor who was teaching it was someone I had done research with. So like, I mean, I understood the way that he thought and like, I mean, it was a pretty hard class. So I was like, okay, great. I can do this. I want to keep doing it. And then in the third term, we had a visiting professor from somewhere in the UK. And I've tried really hard to figure out who this person is, but my Gmail records don't go that far back. And I can't find him on like, I've tried to look. So there's some math professor in abstract algebra who apparently came on sabbatical to Caltech every several years. And I didn't realize this was a thing, but he would come and he would teach abstract algebra really, really, really hard to the point that all the first year PhD students would drop the class and not do abstract algebra that year. So I got hit with that.
Right.
And like a class was just impossibly hard. And you know, I think after our midterm exam, I heard from a friend from a friend that he went and joked with the more senior PhD students. He's like, look what I gave my students. And they're just like, this is ridiculous.
Right.
So after that,
he knew how hard he was
making. Yeah, he knew how hard it was. And he thought this was great. And like, pretty much all the PhD students dropped out of the class. And all that was left was like three of us undergrads who were like, we don't understand what's going on. So after that experience, I thought like, maybe I'm not actually good at this. And I only found out that this was a recurring cycle about a year later when I met another algebra professor on campus. And I was just walking across campus and he's like, why did you change your area of interest? And I'm just like, it was so impossibly hard. And he's like, well, I mean, didn't you know that that's just how this guy is?
You tell this story like with a big smile on your face and you're clearly a smiley person. This sounds horrendous to me. This doesn't sound good.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, well, the teaching at Caltech is not, I think there's a lot of variation. And I mean, on the faculty side, like, you're welcome to do whatever you want with your class.
Okay. So you dropped out.
Yeah. I mean, what I did sort of, so I ended up like, well, okay. So it's very different from Cambridge, right? You have grades for each term in many American universities. And at Caltech, I'd taken the first two quarters for credit and gotten really good grades. And it turned out I could take the third quarter as a pass fail. And it would be fine. Like, you know, my GPA would be just as high. So that's what I opted for. And in fact, when I told the professor, he begged me to take it for credit because he said it would look really bad if like very few students took it for credit.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. But, like, you know, psychologically, I was just like, no, I don't know that I can do this anymore. So
do you think in another world, if it hadn't been for this terrible experience, mm-hmm. you could have kept going with abstract algebra?
I think so. I mean, I liked it. There's certain things that I found very beautiful about it. I mean, what's a little bit unfortunate is that, like, I know I built up such a great intuition for abstract algebra, and having not really done anything in abstract algebra since my second or third year of university, I now don't have.
So tell me, how does this fit into your story of moving into statistics?
Like, yeah.
So you've dropped out of abstract algebra, mm-hmm. even though it was something you thought you liked.
Well, let's see. So I started taking some classes that were more towards computer science. So the work that I do even now lies kind of at the intersection between statistics, applied math, computer science, electrical engineering. Like, it's all kind of related to, you know, data, modern types of data, and how you prove things probabilistic about them. So I started taking some classes that were in theoretical computer science, which is very mathematical. And there was a professor I took a class from, and he was doing something, and he still does something that was very novel, sort of using DNA to compute. So what you do is you somehow program some simple calculation you want to do into DNA. Then you run an experiment and have things kind of, you know, recombine however they do. And based on the concentrations at the end, you declare what the conclusion of your calculation is. So I just thought that, like, you know, he was clearly using math and very rigorous and abstract math, but using it in some way that was like kind of towards biology.
Biology's back.
Yeah, biology's back. Yeah. Right. And then, so actually I kind of wanted to work with him on research that summer, but then he told me he wasn't taking any students. So I instead went to work with a professor who happened to live in our dorm because he and his wife were renovating their house. So they lived in our dorm for 2 years, and I knew him. I didn't really know his research area, but I thought, like, you know, he does electrical engineering, but like the theoretical side of it. So then I did some work with him, and it was on, from a mathematical standpoint, it was like very, very easy math. But he was, in some very abstract sense, he was modeling how the brain works. So he was modeling the brain as a series of electric circuits and sort of saying, what if these electric circuits have some probability of being closed versus open? And what kinds of overall connection probabilities can you make by putting together these different series of circuits. So, I mean, that summer, like, the main proof was a proof by induction, which is like, you know, very, very basic mathematics. But it sort of opened my mind to like using perhaps very simple math to infer something about like the real world, even though real models of the brain are going to be much, much more complicated than these random circuits. So then in my last year of undergrad, I needed to choose, I wanted to do a PhD in something mathematical. And I asked this professor, so he had done his PhD in electrical engineering at Stanford. He was from Israel. He'd come over for his PhD. And I told him I would like to be just like him and, you know, go do a PhD in electrical engineering at Stanford or wherever. And then he said, well, you know, the thing is, in your first year of PhD in America, there are often qualifying exams. And depending on the university and depending on the topic, well, at Stanford, for instance, you would need to take an exam in the first year that has all this background in electrical engineering that, like, I didn't know anything about. So I knew the mathematical corner of it, but not all the other stuff that they take. So he said, why don't you look at all the universities you'd like to go through, So, I mean, Stanford, but also other places like Berkeley, Harvard, Chicago, all these good places, and just decide at each university what program makes sense to you based on the requirements and the potential faculty you would work with. So I ended up applying to something like 10 universities, and I think like probably 7 of them were in applied math. And then I applied to Carnegie Mellon in computer science with a focus on computational biology. So there's the biology thing again. At MIT, I applied in electrical engineering, and in Berkeley, I applied in statistics. So there's like one school I applied to in statistics. And then going to Berkeley and visiting and meeting the faculty, it just seemed like a great fit.
So it was you liking Berkeley as a place that resulted in you studying statistics rather than statistics itself.
Yeah. A place and also the faculty. But the thing is that the statistics department at Berkeley had faculty who were cutting across applied math, computer science, and so on. But there was definitely some of the location thing, right? So I visited some of the schools on the East Coast, and it was like February, so it was freezing at MIT, and everyone was running from building to building. And then I went to Berkeley after that, and there are these, you know, big fields with sunshine, and I thought, like, wouldn't it be nice to sit here and study? Of course, when I got to Berkeley, I mostly studied in my office, but, you know, it was just like the concept of
it wasn't statistics
nice
in
weather.
The sunshine.
No, not usually.
No. I'd like to take a very quick pause to thank the Leverhulme Trust for making this episode possible. If you haven't heard of them, the Trust is a charity focused on funding what you could call blue sky research and scholarship. It's been running for over 100 years, and one of its big things is taking risks on people who have the potential to generate new ideas, breakthroughs that could benefit society. Poling, who you're listening to now, herself received a prestigious Philip Leverhulme Prize. That's £100,000 towards advancing her research. And you're about to hear more about that research in just a few minutes. But to find out more about the Leverhulme Trust, its prize winners, and upcoming opportunities perhaps, see the links that accompany this episode. Once you started getting into the statistics and started doing it as a PhD, did it feel right straight away? Was it a real natural fit for you? Was there a period of adjustment thinking, oh, is this what I want? Or did it feel right?
I think there was definitely a period of adjustment, but it just so happened that all the other first-year PhD students in my cohort had backgrounds in pure math. So we were similarly clueless about what we were getting ourselves into. I mean, everyone had their own reason for going to do a PhD in statistics, but most of us hadn't taken more than a very basic statistics class that said, like, what's a hypothesis test, what's the rule you should do, and so on. I mean, one thing that I think... And I say this too to students that I mentor, especially undergraduates who are coming from a pure math degree, is that, you know, one difference between statistics and other areas of pure math is that in pure math, oftentimes your question is pretty well defined. In statistics, there's a lot of figuring out what's the right question to ask. And maybe you can't exactly solve the question, but then you change it to something that's also meaningful and you solve that instead. And that kind of, you know, moving goalposts, constantly shifting around and being okay with that was something that I think it took me like a good 2 years to sort of get used to. And then you develop a taste for like what's the right type of problem to ask.
I was going to, my next question was going to be, what's the difference between math and statistics?
Yeah.
You've said one there. Are there any others? It feels to me like, I mean, you hinted earlier that you have a bit of an interest in reading and language to a degree, obviously, then as well. And it feels like statistics starts to maybe tickles that part of your brain more than pure math, because you have to start thinking about real world problems.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I think one thing we get away with in statistics is that it's totally fine to say that things hold with high probability. And I think like in pure math, a lot of times you think about sort of corner cases. You ask yourself, is this conjecture true? And then if you find a counterexample, you're happy, you sleep well, right? Otherwise, you're just like thinking all night, like, you know, is the conjecture true? How do I prove it? Once you come with a counterexample, you're like, problem solved. Whereas in statistics, the mentality is like, okay, there is a corner case that's a counterexample. What should the real question be? And then you proceed. So I think there's definitely a different part of the brain that's involved in this.
Is statistics easier than math?
It's hard to say. I think there are definitely parts of statistics that can be very, very hard mathematically. I have taught for the last few years a third year class at Cambridge. It's called Principles of Statistics. And at least the current manifestation of this class, which was redesigned maybe 10 or 15 years ago, is to teach people that statistics is a part of pure math, because the undergrads we have are coming from a pure math background. So then we cover some pretty technical parts of statistics that sort of go towards real analysis, measure theory. But then it's completely, like, it's fine. It's, one can go through statistics and sort of emphasizing those parts, right? And so there are different angles you can take on statistics. And actually, one angle that I take is that perhaps this is because of my abstract algebra background, is that there are lots of problems in statistics that progress can be made by framing things as a problem in linear algebra. And when I frame something in linear algebra, I'm like, oh, yeah, I like to think about it this way. So there are a lot of interesting breakthroughs in statistics that you can do by thinking about things in terms of matrices and vectors and all that.
Do you find there are any preconceptions or ideas that other people in mathematics have towards statistics, like a snobbishness or a thought that you're a poor relation? Do you ever encounter that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, it's maybe less so in Cambridge because we're in the department of pure math and mathematical statistics. But I think this is sort of a well-founded criticism. And the problem is that the first class you learn in statistics, even at Cambridge when it's taught to pure math students, is not very rigorous or technical, right? I mean, because later on, if you're going to do research in theoretical statistics, you still need to have all the basic definitions. You have to know, like, what is a hypothesis test? What does it look like in various manifestations? What is a confidence interval, right? And you can easily spend a whole lecture saying, well, here's a linear model. This is linear regression. This is what a confidence interval looks like. I'm now going to write this ginormous equation. And then now, if you don't know these other things, this is what it looks like. And people get put off by that because then they think, all I have to do is memorize these ginormous equations. But that's sort of necessary if you're going to go further and try to generalize the theory that leads to these things.
What are you doing now?
So I've become quite interested in this area of, well, I don't know what to call it, whether it's theoretical computer science or statistics, but differential privacy, which I've sort of landed on in a strange way. So my PhD was in an area called high dimensional statistics. The concept is that you have lots of possible parameters and not so many observations. So the classical example is like you have, maybe you're trying to figure out which genes cause a disease. And the number of genes you're looking at might be like tens of thousands. And the number of observations you have is you only have hundreds of people. So you need to, first of all, make some assumptions that only a few genes might cause the disease. And then you need to come up with some methods that will find them. And this is often framed in some kind of optimization problem. In optimization, oftentimes what people want to do is they want to optimize what are called convex functions. So they look like a bowl. And the idea is that if you are doing some iterative method to find the minimum, then you just walk in the direction of decreasing. And this works if it's convex. But there are interesting functions that might not be convex, that might be useful for various reasons. In my PhD, I studied some variants of these methods of, you know, finding structure in high dimensional data when you have some kind of non-idealities. So this might be missing data or some sort of extra noise in your observations. And this leads to non-convex functions. So if you talk to an optimization theorist, they'll be like, it's not convex, you can't conclude anything. Because maybe your function looks like a squiggly line. How are you going to find an optimum in a fast amount of time? But in statistics, you know, we care about things holding probabilistically. And it turns out that if you look at a random, an average case manifestation of the function, it's not so bad. Whereas if you looked at a worst case squiggly function, there's no way of optimizing it. So that was what I spent a lot of time thinking about theoretically in my PhD. And then after my PhD, I ended up sort of walking into an area of statistics called robust statistics, where robustness is trying to deal with outliers in the data. And it turns out that non-convex functions also manifest themselves in robust statistics because you sort of want to tamper down the effect of outliers. So you start looking at non-convex loss functions. So the technical theory that I spent my PhD doing very easily translated into robust statistics, for which people had not studied this in a high-dimensional setting. So I spent probably about 8 years post-PhD thinking about robust statistics. And then very recently, I realized that there were connections between robust statistics and this area of differential privacy. And
What is differential privacy?
Yeah, so differential privacy is actually the method that many of the big tech companies like Apple, Facebook, Google use to protect your personal data. So they have some standards, and the standards are based on some theory that comes from mostly theoretical computer scientists. So the principle is that if you provide your data to the database, then whatever information they release, like let's say the average time you spend on the screen in your iPhone, right? I mean, they don't want that to be too sensitive to any individual's data. And that's supposed to give you some reassurance that, you know, you might as well give them your data, because whatever they release publicly, like, of course, they know everything, but what they release publicly isn't going to say too much about you.
Yeah.
And that's why it's called differential privacy. It's differential. Whether you are included or not in the database won't change the output too much. So there are all sorts of techniques that people use for embedding differential privacy in any algorithm they're using. Now, the connection to robustness, so at an intuitive level, if you have some statistical method for estimating something robustly, then it shouldn't change too much if one data point is changed. And in robust statistics, you care about it from the outlier perspective. If you put in an outlier, it shouldn't change too much. Whereas in differential privacy, I mean, whatever data point you feed in, it shouldn't change too much. So although I wasn't completely sold on the formalisms for differential privacy, like, I mean, is this guarantee I mentioned strong enough for you to want to give them your data? Probably not. But given that that is what's already being implemented, I became interested in using the techniques I had to sort of make some advances in this field of privacy.
Why? Why did you want to make advances in the field of differential privacy? Did you read an article one day and you thought, I want to get involved? did you fall into it serendipitously? It doesn't seem like something you would wake up in the morning and think, do you know what? This is the thing I want to improve.
I mean, so I've always been sort of, at least since my PhD, I've kind of been drifting along. Like, I see tech, I think one thing I'm very good at is sort of taking different ideas that don't seem that similar and drawing bridges between them. So in this case, it seemed like a really good opportunity, right? I mean, before it was like non-convexity was what bridged high-dimensional statistics and robust statistics. And then now it's like there are these sort of algorithmic methods that bridge robustness and differential privacy. I mean, on another level, so I spent a year at Columbia University in New York in 2019 to 2020, and I had a good friend who also had worked on robust statistics in the past, and he was making this bridge to differential privacy. So I had lunch with him, like, you know, every week for a couple of months, and then I was sort of like, okay, this is interesting. It's interesting math to study.
You've done lots of work and studied in the US. Mm-hmm. You now live and work in the UK, here in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. Is it different being a mathematician, a statistician, an academic in the UK compared to the US?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's my first time being a statistician in a math department. So it's kind of fun because the work that I do, so I tend to kind of go back and forth between different communities. So there's the statistics community, then there's theoretical computer science, electrical engineering, I guess on electrical engineering side, there are information theorists who do some similar types of stuff. And in mathematics, there are probabilists. So it's sort of nice to, you know, be able to embrace the fact that some of the work I do, you know, it's also quite related to areas of math, like probability, for instance. I mean, algebra maybe a little bit less so. So in terms of, you know, the work environment, the sorts of seminars I could go to, it's quite nice. I also think that it's a lot of fun to interact with pure math undergrads because, you know, they have a similar viewpoint as I was as an undergrad, right? Like they think that they know exactly what they want to do and, you know, I'll support that. It's fine. But it's also fun to sort of expand their horizons a bit and be like, you know, statistics might actually be something you might want to study in the future. I don't know.
What about the culture though of like academia? Is that like, you know, more competitive or less competitive or more friendly or less friendly or mm-hmm. more conservative or let you know with a small c or like like does it feel different to being an academic in America?
So I guess it's also hard to say because, I mean, on the one hand, there's the whole cultural difference, but on the other hand, there's, you know, it depends on what university you're at. So even in America, I sort of moved between various universities. So my husband is an academic, so to solve our two-body problem, it took some work. So I spent, my first faculty job was at University of Pennsylvania, where the statistics department is in the business school. So University of Pennsylvania, I didn't realize this before I joined, is an Ivy League school. the nomenclature, right? It sounds like, you know, University of Wisconsin, like public school, right? Anyway, so it's super rich. The statistics department in the business school, super rich, right? All the resources you need are there. It's also a very, very good university and department. So, you know, if you want, when we try to hire people, then whoever you want to hire, like, with has a high likelihood of actually accepting the offer and coming, right? Then I spent some time in Wisconsin, which was, you know, a great solution to our two body problem. And I spent about 5 years there. But there always, it always felt like, you know, it could be better, right? In terms of, like, you know, faculty who stay, attractiveness to new candidates, you know, strength of the students. And then I was at Columbia for just a year. So I got a little whiff of the sort of elite university part again. And coming to Cambridge, like, it's sort of nice to be sort of at the top of things again, right?
Yeah.
And so that's nice. But I guess another thing is, culturally, I do feel like people do work-life balance way better in the UK than they do in America.
Yeah.
So I have appreciated that. Like, I mean, there are plenty of people who work all the time, but if you don't, that's, like, completely fine, which is very nice.
That's not fine in the US?
So it depends on where you are. I mean, I used to tell people that when I was starting off at University of Pennsylvania, for instance, like, I would meet other young faculty at sort of orientation events, and people would say, oh, you know, we should hang out. But then you just, like, wouldn't hang out for the longest time. And then when I went to Wisconsin, it would be like, okay, we should hang out. Let's, like, hang out tonight. And I realized that it wasn't so much that people in Wisconsin were working less than people in Pennsylvania, especially as, like, starting out assistant professors. But there was this perception that, like, in one place, you should make it seem like you're always busy and, you know, you don't really have time, versus, like, you make time and you have your regular life. And I think, like, at Cambridge, both would be totally fine, right? Everyone sort of understands that, you know, people have they're very serious about their work and they're doing good work. And then how you choose to spend your time day to day or week to week is completely up to you.
Does your father still work in statistics?
Yeah, I mean, he could retire, but he hasn't, because, you know, they worked for a while in America too.
Does he ever look at your work? Like, do you follow each other's work, or have you ever crossed over in any way?
No, I mean, I think my father for a long time just, like, felt like he shouldn't interfere and shouldn't, you know, influence my path. I think at some point a few years back, I realized that some other people I knew whose parents were academics had, like, published papers, and I thought that would be really cool. But I guess our research interests are quite divergent right now. So, I mean, he also started out as a theoretician, but then over the last 30 years, he's moved more into sort of applied statistics, where, you know, my training is more in the theoretical field. So I think in order to understand each other, we would need to spend quite a bit of time, like, you know, reading about each other's work, and that just hasn't happened.
So you don't even talk work with him when you go home for Thanksgiving or something? You won't sit at the table and talk stats?
No. I mean, he's never... So the only time that he did that was when we were very little, and his mission was to convince us that you shouldn't always trust the statistics you see in the media. So he would sort of sit down at the breakfast table and he would tell us, here's some article that's reporting blah, blah, blah. What's wrong with it? And then my sense... I mean, I was the youngest of three, right? So I couldn't really reason through this very well, but I just figured that if there's a statistical study, it's probably wrong. So yeah, that was the extent to which he ever kind of discussed statistics and the work that he did.
Okay. I know your husband works in the mathematical sphere as well. And I know you have two very young children. Are you making them count crayons? Do you want them to become mathematicians? Are they going to live your life?
Well, I mean, I think my husband and I would love for them to, you know, at least be good at math, right? Like, to see this passion, because they see their parents, like, doing things and talking about math. But at least the four-year-old has a very strong personality. And I mean, well, of course, my very biased viewpoint, like, I think she's very smart, but she doesn't like to be taught. So if we, I mean, she learned to count up to 10 very early on, but then she always got confused somewhere around 16 and 17. And you would think, like, if she's gotten everything else up to 20, it should be easy to straighten that out. But the moment you tell her you're trying to teach her that, she'll just, like, refuse. Not, she'll refuse to repeat it after you. She'll even refuse to learn it. She just, like, blocks it out. And then she'll go to school later on where people are, or her nursery, where people are doing this or that. She comes home and she knows it. So, I mean, I think at the moment, maybe she's, well, yeah, at the moment, I hope that she does something mathematical. I'd be happy to teach her things if she wanted me to, but she doesn't.
I think for most people, statistics, like, might be like sport or election polls and things like that. And it involves adding numbers up and averaging it and a few graphs and things. But from talking to you, it feels like statistics is a field where there are lots of cutting edges and frontiers and things that we don't know how to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could go both ways. I guess for analyzing a lot of problems, like, you know, in sports statistics and so on, right? I mean, okay, so I've never actually consulted for this, so I don't really know what the complications are, at least as a theoretician, right? I mean, there are a lot of things that are new and interesting. So for instance, I mentioned like high dimensions, right? I mean, just the fact that suddenly you have all this data and you have lots of different things that could predict something and you don't have that many observations. Like, this is a new phenomenon from like the last, you know, 15 years. And there are other settings, like they call it online learning. So you have data and it's coming to you one observation at a time. And for whatever reason, you know, maybe it's storage or computation, you don't want to estimate something based on looking at all the data you've already collected. You want to keep some kind of running update of what is your best estimator and update it with each observation. Other interesting problems are like you have graphs, you have networks. So you have data from a Facebook network and you want to make some sense out of it, right? So there are lots of different problems that I think have arisen in recent years. And I'm sure if you talk to a statistician like 10 or 20 years ago, they would also say like there are all these interesting problems that have sort of manifested themselves.
Does statistics have its version of like the Riemann hypothesis, like some problem or unknown thing that whoever solved it would become like, you know, the legend of the field? Is there a big burning problem in statistics?
I think it really depends on, you know, I think it depends on who you ask, because statistics is fairly diverse too. I mean, even within high dimensional statistics, I feel like, you know, there are just lots of different interesting questions, but maybe not sort of one clear question to ask.
Some people I speak to in your job love doing research and teaching's a bit of a chore. Other ones like love the teaching, like that's what they're here for. Where are you? Where do you stand on this teaching versus doing your research?
Yeah, I mean, I do very much like teaching. I always have, but I think as an academic, I feel like you never have enough time to do everything as well as you would like. So for teaching especially, I feel like it's never as good as I would like, because there's the pressure to do research too. So oftentimes I'll teach a class and feel like I'm not quite as prepared as I wish I was, or I wish I had presented things differently. So yes, I like teaching, but I mean, there's some, I definitely feel the tension between teaching and research and all the other duties.
What's next for you? What do you want to do? Where do you want to be in 20 years? Still in Cambridge?
I think I want to settle down. I mean, after having moved around the US a bunch, being at three universities, I think we're quite ready to settle down. And then, of course, having kids, like, they don't want to keep changing their lives. So
no. But do you feel English? Do you feel English now?
No. I mean, I passed my life in the UK test. That was pretty stressful.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me some things you learned during that have stuck in your head. Like, that you thought, is that true? Is that real?
I mean, maybe one thing that's a little bit hilarious. Anyway, so I memorized the fact that Christopher Cockerell invented the hovercraft, right? Because that's one of the things we have to remember.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So anyway, you know, I remembered that. And then a week after the test, my four-year-old started talking about hovercrafts. And then I was like, well, I know who invented that. I don't actually know what a hovercraft is. And then my four-year-old started explaining it to me. I mean, I didn't quite know what it hovered on, because I'd never like bothered to look it up or seen one in real life. And I'm just like, so yeah, this test, you know, teaches us these things.
What a crazy thing they expect you to learn. Do you like fish and chips?
Yeah, it's okay on occasion. Maybe I'll like graze off of somebody's plate, but I don't think I'd eat that as a meal.
Is there anything about yourself that you think has become a bit anglicized? You think, oh gosh, I didn't used to do that, and now I do because I live here.
I think slowly over time, I'm starting to say things like, you know, I don't know whether to call a stroller a pram or a buggy or what. Sometimes I call diapers nappies. Like for the last couple of years, I've really been resisting this and being like, I'll use my American words, but you just kind of get immersed in it.
What do you call one of these?
A cell phone?
Right.
Instead of a mobile?
Yeah. Just checking. What do you call the big thick thing that you pull over yourself at night to sleep under when it's cold?
A comforter.
Right. That's a duvet.
Yeah. Very good.
Thanks again to the Leverhulme Trust for supporting this episode. Find out more about what they've done, what they're doing, what's coming up in the future via the links for this episode. I'm Brady Harron, and you've been listening to the Number File podcast.